Hey, good morning, welcome to Fox Orange Podcast. Me, Patrick Guest, Tim Stever here.
Go ahead. Hey, yo.
Patrick Guest, figure Tennessee is to a cute Erie.
Daddy, my cute Erie?
Yes.
Nice. And our very, very special guest, Seth Thomas Charles Booty.
Thanks.
What?
Yes. So let's see. It's Good Friday.
Yep.
Seth has today off. And so it was like, well, yeah, well, of course we're going to podcast. I mean, the number of emails we get addressed to Seth has increased dramatically. Or they call Seth the true host of the show, the driving force
of the show.
Nate is green with envy. Let's just put it that way. Seth's way better looking. Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So Seth Erie.
Yes.
And there's a shot. Seth and I are going to go to Good Friday service tonight.
Yep.
And we think we're going to serve communion together.
Yes.
Yes. Nice. That would be really fun. I know. Seth has been getting in the communion line all by himself and taking the bread and the cup every week. And so we thought it'd be cool to hand that out. So we'll see.
Nice.
We're not sure.
Yep.
Anything else you want to share with the internet?
Peace out.
Peace out. Wow.
Leave him wanting more.
Yep. Always. Always. Things his dad never does. Brief and to the point. Timothy, how are you? How's your week been?
Great. Kids are on spring break, but I am not. So I've just been leaving them and going to work.
Perfect.
Can't miss that.
No. And is your wife on spring break too?
She is.
Oh, okay. Okay. Because I thought maybe you were leaving them just alone while you went to work.
Well, we have been a little bit lately. Elliot's 12 now, so.
Yeah.
I mean, it's close. If we're staying fairly local, yeah, we'll leave them home. And we pay him to babysit and we pay her to listen.
That is. Yeah. Yeah, that's fantastic. That's funny. I think we should do that with our listeners.
Pay them to listen.
You know? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if we're looking for strategies to grow the podcast, maybe that's the reverse tithe is how we should do that. Timothy, it's Easter week. We're recording this on Good Friday. Mm-hmm. And you can hear Seth, I think, flopping in the background. He's got some very unique takes on the floppies these days. Yep. And the only thing, I mean, the thing that really kicked my Easter preparations into gear was the reissuing of the God Bless the USA Bible.
Oh my.
With the former president's personal endorsement.
Yeah.
And that, I tell you what, that got me in an intellectual and emotional space to celebrate the death and resurrection of Jesus. No question about it. I just love it because it's got, first of all, it's got the lyrics of God Bless the USA song,
which is
inspired by the Bible, mm-hmm. no doubt.
Oh yeah.
And then the founding documents, which is awesome. Yeah. And I mean,
that's Bible part two,
listen,
right?
Yes, you could not ask for a more comprehensive set of divinely inspired works.
That's right. It's the new
than
new
that
Testament.
Bible. So yes, the new NEU Testament. So anyway, I just was like, oh, perfect.
Well, you and I and our mutual friend will text, and it's like, I feel like there used to be satire in.
Yeah, there's
in each
nothing.
Other, and now it's like this is actually just reality.
Yeah,
and you can't even it's kind of killing satire. It's like, where do you go?
Well, how do you parody something like that? I mean, it's
I
like
don't think
this...
you can.
No,
it is
I don't
a parody
think you can.
In and of itself.
Yep, and so hallelujah. You know, nothing says you know, keep the focus on Jesus like an endorsed Bible with lyrics and founding documents. Perfect.
Yeah.
No confusion there. We got some emails turning a corner. I just was like, oh my goodness. And we got some emails about the Royal Dignity of Seth Erie episode, mm-hmm. which we just reestablished in that open. We got a comment on YouTube. By the way, we have a YouTube channel. We have 1.97 thousand subscribers, guys.
Hey, yo.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh. That's pretty immense. And, you know, of those 1.97 thousand subscribers, we probably have 12 people that watch. So I just want to say thank you for those of you who said subscribe. Yeah. Yeah. For those of you that hit subscribe and then never watch it. First of all, I wouldn't either. It's pretty boring. I think maybe people are like, ooh, you know, what are their faces like? And they go on and watch once and then it's cool. Over.
Maybe we need some animated segments or something or puppets.
Yeah. Yeah. SNL shorts. Ooh, puppets. I like it. Anyway, we got a comment. This person said, I would be interested in a conversation around the idea of, quote, correcting conditions. For example, my sister was born deaf before the time of cochlear implants. She would say she is very glad she was never, quote, fixed. If we could correct all disabilities or congenital issues, should we? I thought that's a great question.
Yeah.
And that ties into the other question that we got via email. I've been listening to the podcast for a few months. I'm loving the current series, Image of God Being Human, conversation around Seth and the distorted views of what being made in the image of God means was especially helpful for me, but it raised a question that I haven't been able to find much direction on yet on my own. My younger brother is 21. He has cerebral palsy, and much like the way you describe Seth, he loves people like crazy and actively images God better than I do in lots of ways. Here's the question. What will people like Seth and my brother be like in the new creation? On the one hand, I know the new creation will be without sickness and suffering and death, and I'm confident my brother, who's now in a wheelchair, will be able to run and dance and do whatever else with his new body. On the other hand, he's already imaging God, and his special needs feel so baked into who he is, and we love who he is. I guess another way to ask this is this: at what point does healing the body, soul, mind of all of us change who we are? And what does that mean for people like my brother and Seth in eternity? So I thought, Tim, I would give you the floor on both of these questions. In terms of correcting, man, I don't know the answer to that. There seems to be a quality of life versus quantity of life issue there. So if somebody has a congenital heart defect that is going to affect how long they live and how well they live, it would seem to be the burden of proof would be on, well, why wouldn't we correct that if it's going to dramatically improve both? Seth has no...
What?
He has no impairedness in his own condition. Like he's totally fine in it of himself. Like he doesn't, like there's nothing, he's not looking out at the world and saying, oh, I'm diminished. If anything, he's now walking behind me.
See, these are the benefits of YouTube.
right. You do get to see Seth Erie's craziness. But there is no felt deficiency in him. In fact, I'm the one that feels deficiencies in myself, where I would, you know, and I would be considered what a typical. He doesn't have that. Yeah. He's totally fine. So I'm not sure what we all would judge to be correctable may not, or you know, something that needs to be corrected. May not be matched with the felt experience of the person that, quote, would need correcting. So I think that's a wonderful question that I don't know the answer to. I do talk to people who have drawn such strength, grace, mercy, intimacy from what would be typically described as disadvantages, physically, mentally, emotionally. And there are some who wouldn't want those changed. And I've met others who would love to have those changed. And so I think we honor the Imago Dei in every person if they're able to let us know their preference on you know, the correction. But I also think, you know, for Sethi and maybe for the emailer's younger brother, you know, that there's nothing that I think he would say or identify as, "Ooh, I really wish this would happen." Yeah. Like there's no other awareness of anything else than other than I'm awesome. And so that's where I think Down syndrome maybe is a unique case, because I've met kids with DS who feel acutely lonely or rejected or whatever. And we've not had yet that experience with Seth. Seth just seems to march around the world pretty much really happy with who he is and how he's received. And so I don't know. That's just a great question. Anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I would never pretend to be able to come close to answering that question. I think, but because of that, I think our society is set up in a way that we have ideas that we think are normal and things that we think are abnormal. And we've structured society in a way where it'll cater to one over the other. And so I just feel like our biggest duty is making as many seats available at the table for as many people as possible and loving them exactly where they are for who they are and just keeping that space open. And just, I feel like that's one of our biggest duties. 'Cause I was talking to students about, like, somebody was writing about something close to this topic, breeding out different things. And we were talking about eugenics and I mean, obviously this is, like, you know, far to the other end of the spectrum of what we're talking about, but this idea of breeding out things that we have deemed to be whatever in society is just
undesirable.
That's a really dark path. So it's like, what's the opposite of that? Seems to be just clearing the table, bringing as many chairs in and wheelchair accessible areas of the table and everything so that everybody can be there and be celebrated for who they are at the table. So I lean more into that, especially with these things that are, I have no idea how to even approach understanding what that
seriously
might mean on the other side of the fence.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I think you're right. If anybody attends Journey, you're going to see about 1,000 smiles from everybody when Seth is up there doing what he's doing. He brings joy to everybody there. So I can't imagine that is a, like, something credible.
How much would I wish how Seth is received for all of the other kids?
Oh, for sure. That's what I mean. Like,
who don't have,
like,
any community
have families. Reason. So it's like, if we can just learn to love people for who they are, not who they aren't or whatever. I don't know.
No, that
seems to be
the
call and the mission, right? And kind of the gospel at the core to a certain extent.
I mean, you know,
dignifying the humanity of everybody and making them know that they're part of something bigger than.
That's it. Just like the founders intended.
There's anyone that makes me think that, it might be somebody I recently saw holding a Bible upside down in front of a church.
Yeah, totally. The other question about new creation, that's interesting to me because I've read some scholarship that has argued, and again, we don't know. I mean, we just don't. End of story, we have no clue. So we're all just guessing.
Yeah.
And whatever new creation is, it's going to be better than anything we can cook up in our own little brains. So guaranteed. I think of it like this. New creation for me means subtraction. So the subtraction of guilt, the subtraction of fear, the subtraction of regret, the subtraction of sin, the subtraction of pain and tears and whatever else. And so I define new creation of all as in terms of all the things that won't be there. For Sethi doesn't define new creation that way. Obviously he's not super familiar with the concept, but for him, we would be tempted to want to see new creation through the lens of addition. Well, he'll be able to do X and Y and Z. I tend to think that because we define new creation for people like Seth in terms of addition and people who are typical in terms of subtraction. I tend to think we're the ones most at risk for change in new creation. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, yes, I agree with the questioners, the younger brother being able to run and to walk, but I have to rack my brain a little bit for Seth. And again, DS is different than autism or cerebral palsy or whatever. But I have to rack my brain a little bit for what needs to be added to Seth to give him more life. Mm-hmm. Like I don't have a long list for him. You know what I mean? Now, that's not true of all DS kids, and it's not true of all kids with special needs. We are familiar, personally familiar with so many heartbreaking cases that new creation will mean mobility and the ability to communicate clearly, the ability to relate fully. Yes. But if we're just talking about Sethy, there isn't much that you would add to him to give a full experience of human life. I would argue he seems to have a fuller experience of human life because he's not dealing with regret, fear, you know, I mean, obviously experiences pain and disappointment, but I don't know. I want to keep reframing the idea that there's something missing here that has to be brought into the equation, a new creation. Right. But for us typical folk, it's all about subtraction.
Yeah, I thought about that a lot this week because I had a very heavy week with students. I was doing conferences like one-on-one and more than you would expect came in kind of like in tears. We were doing conferences over like paper writing, not like therapy.
Yeah, it turns into all kinds of good stuff, like, I would imagine.
It's just like the unforeseen burdens that people are carrying around, like just in real time every day is kind of immense, and it's stuff we don't see until we're engaging with somebody and kind of the walls come down a little bit. So I was thinking about that kind of stuff in light of this week, where it was like just these, like, and a lot of it's pain that has been inflicted by other people's like selfishness or whatever, like parental or whatever, so within the family unit, and the pain that causes. And I'm just like, being able to see that might be something that is alleviated, the selfishness, and because then you start thinking about that. And you know, you and I are both trying to, or you're probably done, I'm still trying to write a Easter message. And so all these ideas of new creation, all these ideas of like, what does it mean to be human together and all this kind of stuff was all, so it's all intertwined, which makes this conversation interesting. Cause it was all like, the whole week was like a vine of all these different things that deal with, how do I not miss the mark as a human, and how do I help other folks hit the mark as well within their lives and that kind of stuff. And you just see that with, I don't see that in this first conversation, but I do see it in the, where they've been hurt and how to, like, whether it's just sitting with somebody in there, dismay or their pain or whatever, or talking with them through it or whatever, there I see that kind of like those burdens being lifted in new creation. It seems to be in this communal thing. So I don't know, but that's at least a place where I feel like I can see that as a, something that's made new or something that's taken away or alleviated or whatever.
Totally. Yeah. And maybe the spectrum that we think we have explored between typical or atypical isn't as cut and dry as we think.
That's what I kind of think might be the case.
That's what I'm hearing from you. Yep, you got your. What do you want?
Aunt pizza.
Okay, so Seth is handing me a waffle that he wants like pizza, which means we cut it or pull it in this case into triangle shapes. So there you go.
Pizza, Daddy.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Tim Stafford.
Thank you, Tim Stafford. We're talking about the waffle.
That's right.
So, yes. So, I mean, and it feels like we're stepping on really holy ground by even, having these conversations. I just, because the kingdom always is upside down, I don't know. I just think new creation will reflect that in some surprising way, you know?
Yeah.
But we've heard from loads of folks just about the dignity of the human image and its implications. So I thought those were two just great questions that who knows, man, yeah. Who knows? How awesome. How awesome. Because if new creation is real, I mean, that's the whole, you know, resurrection story, then we can hold in tension the absolute dismay and hardship and terror and existential dread of human life.
Yeah.
And the hope and possibility that it won't always be this way, you know? And yeah. I don't know. That's a pretty, it seems like Christians err on one or two of those, you know, they err on one side or the other. That we're just so hopeful and rosy and cliched that we're never in touch with human suffering. Or we're so in touch with human suffering that we just cease being people of hope at all. Just
stuck in the quicksand.
And we're just stuck. And it's like the New Testament presents this weird portrait of both, of a whole community that lives in tension, naming evil as really evil, not disguised good. And the whole, and then Paul saying things like, yeah, our light momentary troubles are achieving for us an eternal glory that will outweigh them all. And you're like,
that's so interesting. Exactly how you just described it.
That's true.
The tension in between those two, like it, and when you say it that way, it makes me, my brain think like it forces you to be active. You can't be sedentary. And when you're in, like when things are like that, when you're being pulled from the two ways or not pulled, but like when you're oscillating and trying to exist within this tension, you can't do it sitting still. So it's a really interesting idea of like, if it forces you to lean in one way and lean in the other way and kind of be aware and be intentional with how you posture yourself, which, you know, we were just having that conversation on over a text with our mutual friend about just being stuck or being unwilling to move. And it's like, this kind of forces you to do that. If you're, I don't know, paying attention is the right way to say that, but
yeah. Yep.
It's got interesting implications.
Right. Speaking of interesting implications.
There it is.
Today, we want to look at another part of the image. All right. Like, so,
you know, then a smart list when they're always trying to figure out a clever way of saying bye. And it's like, they're just looking for one person to set it up somehow.
Yep. You did it, dude. You're the master. You're the man. You don't even try. That's how good you are. You don't even try. So Genesis 1, we talked about, you know, the a little bit of the genre for Genesis 1, and the fact that we're not getting scientific textbooks or video recordings of things that happened. We're sort of getting these mythic archetypical retellings, and it's just, it's so much deeper, richer, more beautiful. And in there, we read about humans being the statues of Yahweh, literally what the word selim or image means. And it means that we're both a noun and a verb. We are a noun in the sense that we are images, and we are a verb in the sense that we do image. So like we're mirrors, and whatever it is, like we're angled mirrors. And so we reflect into the world whatever it is we're looking upon. And so idolatry is when you're looking upon and devoting to a piece of creation and imaging creation back to creation, which just further pollutes creation. Or if you're imaging, in our case, the beauty of Jesus back into creation. So we are images in every way, shape, and form. And even though there has been corruption that's been introduced into the human family, our image bearing remains, so that the basis of human ethics is this: how you treat creation is how you treat creator. And so there is no, you know, there is no human. We can have human opponents, but we don't have human enemies, and the battle's not against flesh and blood, and so on and so on and so on. So, when we That's Matthew 1:26. God said, let us make humanity in our image, in our likeness. And then the purpose of the image is to rule. So the reason there are images is so that they would rule over the fish of the sea, birds of the sky, livestock, wild animals, over the creatures that move along the ground. Now, then here's our first bit of poetry that gets introduced. And if you look at it in English Bibles, there's kind of an indent and a separation for verse 27. It says, so God created humanity in his own image. It's three lines. So God created humanity in his own image. In the image of God, he created them. Male and female, he created them. All right, now, those three lines are a form of Hebrew parallelism, because there's a little bit of repetition, but each line repeats with a bit of difference. So on the one hand, it says God created humanity. Now, and remember, the word for humanity here is Adam, Adam. Adam is not a proper name until later. Right now, it's just humans, plural. So God created humans in his image. He created him, singular, in the image of God, plural, and he created them, plural, male and female, plural. All right, so that's verse 26. Verse 27 is our first instance of kind of a poetic refrain, and we get a couple of these at key points in the Genesis 1 through 3 narrative. This is our first one, and so in your English Bibles, it'll be sort of indented and a little separated. And it says, so God created humanity in his own image. In the image of God, he created them, singular. Male and female, he created them, plural. All right, so one of the ways that Hebrew poetry expresses itself is by repetition with minor difference. So if you break, and again, I mean, it's tough to show on a podcast, but if you break these three lines down, the first part is God created, and then second line is he created, third line, he created. In the first line, it's humanity, Adam. Adam isn't a proper name until later, so it's just the human species. He created humanity, he created him, and then he created them. Those are the three lines. God created humanity, he created him, he created them. God created humanity in his image. He created him in the image of God. He created them, male and female. So that way of repeating with minor difference is emphasizing that the divine image is constituted in some crucial way by the duality of gender, that there's one singular humanity. There's only one species of human. But that species is comprised of two, male mm-hmm. and female, and so that grammatically here, humanity is singular and plural, right? He created him, he created them, in the image plural of God, and so you've got these singular plural things that are happening, and male and female are they're the biological Hebrew words for male and female. They're not the social words for like husband and wife that we encounter later. So God is creating the human species in the first line in his image, but in his image means that the one human species is made as male and female. Are you with me so far?
With you.
And yeah. And so there's something about plurality and unity. And we talked about this before when we talked about sexuality. Like when we get to two and we talk about, you know, all of a sudden you're introduced to marriage, like a man will leave his father and mother and be united to his wife, the two will become one flesh. And the reason why Paul will later use that verse in Ephesians as an argument about why the church should be one is that the image of God is reflected when many who are different but similar join together in oneness. That dynamic of unity with slight difference, but still unity, that dynamic is like Paul, that feeds Paul's vision for the church. That's why he'll say this weird thing like, hey, I'm talking about a husband and a wife, but I'm really talking about Christ and the church. And you're like, right. What? And so there is this whole like theme of the many becoming one together.
Yeah.
And that dynamic somehow reflects the image of God. Now, later folks, you know, in the New Testament will go, well, that's Trinitarian, but Moses didn't, you know, as Moses right. was receiving this or editing it or whatever he was doing, Moses didn't have Trinitarian theology in his brain. We'll later look and go, oh, well, yeah, I mean, okay, so the Father is God, the Son is God, the Spirit is God, but they're not all the same person. Mm-hmm. And so what human beings image is that crucial aspect about the nature of God's difference. But this wasn't there. This was right. kind of revolutionary stuff. Like we've talked about sticks of dynamite brought into right. the ancient world. Well, stick number one is that human beings are images, not in what they do, but in who they are. Stick number two is that it's everybody, not just kings. And then stick of dynamite number three is that it includes women as fully equal partners. And, yeah. you know, in the ancient Near East, shockingly, women were not highly valued. I know we can't even fathom that today. It's so different. But back in the day, they were really considered, you know, second class citizens. And so, I mean, and again, we read this and we're all, and we just go, oh, yeah, well, of course. No, this stuff, like, so there are parts where the Genesis story will echo other ancient Near Eastern creation stories. And that really disturbs people, and it shouldn't. That's just a form of literature that was floating around in the ancient world.
Right.
What jumps out is how the Genesis story is so different from the echoes of other creation stories.
Right.
Right? That God made humans not to enslave them, which is one very famous Babylonian epic, but rather to give them power and authority and bestow upon them royal imagery. Right. I mean, just ridiculous. And here that the image of God consists of not male or female, or just male with an assist from female, but it's male and female yeah. are both needed to image, right? Because the image isn't found in the monolith. The image is found in the unity of difference, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that's interesting implications to our initial conversation.
Oh, bro, we're going to get there. So yeah, the many becoming one, I mean, this becomes the central metaphor of the church, right? I mean, unity is how that oneness is expressed in the church. And that becomes the most important thing. So it's interesting that on the front side of the poem and the back side of the poem, humans are called to rule. And we're going to look at that in a couple of other next couple of episodes, the implications, because you were right to say, well, what's rule look like? Because obviously here, the humans are not called to rule each other. They're called to rule jointly over creation. So how many humanities are on planet Earth? Just one species. But of what does that species consist? Male and female. So the one species consists of two. So they image God in their oneness yet two-ness. Mm-hmm. And that becomes the basis of sexual ethics, is that the image of God is found in the reunification of the atom that was split. And we'll get to that in chapter two. Now, there's some, bro, I mean, that's the creation story. Now, there's some massive, massive implications, Mr. Stafford. And I know we're taking this series in like bite-sized chunks. And I'm trying to do that because as we went through Revelation, there's a too fast or too slow dynamic that I want to avoid. Like there were episodes we would do with like an hour and a half of content. And it's thick stuff. And it's like, are we getting this? And so I'd rather like maybe go a little slower and do bite-sized chunks. So we'll see. We'll see. Yeah. So let's explore four or five implications. The first one is this. And this is one we've already referenced, but one we're going to keep coming back to. In Genesis 1, there is utterly and absolutely no hierarchy between male and female. Not one bit. Yep. And so there will be people who will argue that in Genesis 2, the man is created first. And so the man has authority because he was created first. And we're gonna debunk that with so much debunking, it's gonna be crazy. So we'll postpone that, but let's just take Genesis as it comes.
Debunked is so hard.
Yeah. Yeah. Like literally, there won't be a bed standing in within 50 miles of
at least
that.
No bunks.
Nope, not even remotely. So we'll get there when we get there. But here, just notice, if we're just approaching the text fresh, there's nothing in here that would ever imply that somehow females are their role is to follow, and the male role is to lead. Right. They share in the dignity of image bearing. They share in the vocation of imaging and ruling and subduing and filling. And as we'll see, the man isn't intended to do any of that by himself. So it's all to be partnership. And so, and it's interesting. I mean, when we get to the chapter 2, there is one thing that's not good, and it's when there's a singular human. Mm-hmm. And that not good stands out so much from Genesis 1, where things we're just told are good. It was 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 very good. So then we get to, here's something not good.
Yeah.
This has massive ramifications, but let's just start by noticing a very obvious one, which is there is no hierarchy here. We get hierarchy in Genesis 3 as part of God's lament. And if you want to start the story there, well, then you're cutting off, you know, parts of the Bible that matter. But that's not where the story starts. So that's big point number one. Big point number two is about procreation. The image of God does not consist in procreating, because the animals are called to fill the earth too. This is very important. So we have a number of friends who've had fertility struggles. Some of them have been overcome through technology. Some of them through sheer luck or God's grace. Others, they would love nothing more than to have children. They're unable to. And there's a very subtle or not so subtle kind of highlighting of kids, you know, is kind of the goal. And and if we're not careful, we're making infertile couples feel like there's something missing or there's something wrong. And so what's interesting is, you know, most humans, of course, will participate in procreation, but it's not essential to our personhood or to our understanding of God's image. Obviously, sexual differentiation is required for procreation, but our status as image bearers is found in ruling and subduing, which you do not need to procreate in order to do. Does that make sense? So because the filling command was given to the animals, that's not uniquely image of God, right? Genesis 1:22, God said to the animals, be fruitful and increase in number and fill the water in the seas and let the birds increase on the earth. Great. Genesis 1:28, God blessed them and said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth. Same command given to animals, to humans. That's not image of God command. So, if you're listening to this and you're single, if you're listening to this and you're divorced, widowed, you're listening to this and you don't have kids of your own, and there's a subtle feeling of there's a deficiency there. That's not the Bible talking. That's something else talking. And because for some reason conservative Christians idolized 1950s nuclear family culture, it's not surprising that people who are infertile or don't have kids for whatever reason often feel very left out.
Yeah.
So I think that's great news for people. Thirdly, and this is a technical point, and we're going back to Carmen Imes. And she makes this point. I'm going to quote for her. Because there are some who argue that intersex or trans people or people who are same-sex attracted, because not everyone fits neatly in the male-female binary, well, then they're not made in the image of God. And just want to put that one, you know, to bed a little bit. So this is what Carmen says, and it's a beautiful point. The text does not say God created the male and female so that they could be his image, in which case our biological sex would be a necessary aspect of our ability to function as God's image. Rather, the text insists that the image status extends to all humans regardless of our sex embodiment. In other words, male and female also functions as the continuum of extremes. Mm-hmm. The point is that our sex, gender, marital status, and parental status are not essential components of our identity as God's image. We will meet many men and women who were engaged in God's work as single people, Paul and Jesus among them. So again, this is, and we, you know, obviously, gender identity, gender roles, gender stereotypes, biological sex, all of that is brought up by this text that it gets thrown around like, well, you know, God made him Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve. And, you know, right. It says male and female, not, you know, gender neutral or whatever. And those are really worthy conversations to be had. In fact, we got a question from somebody that we may explore. The issue is, as I've dipped my toe in researching some of these issues, the amount of complexity is so far above my pay grade that I just want to note it just for now that every human being is in the image of God regardless.
We're going to start there. Yeah.
Let's just start there. So let's say you're very opposed to some of the gender ideology that's out there. That does not mean that we get to treat image bearers as non-image bearers. And if you ever, yeah, end of story. So, you know, if we're going to be concerned about some of this stuff, let's be concerned about it. And let's practice the way of Jesus as we express our concerns about it. Mm-hmm. So this means, minimally, it seems to me, that we're not kicking people out of our churches and our families. Obviously, there are egregious examples where, you know, your right. kid is stealing from you or harming. I'm not saying in general, but I'm saying simply because your kid comes to you and says, hey, I'm gay, or I feel like I'm a man trapped in a woman's body. There has been a Christian move, quote unquote, to sort of excise those people from places of worship or places of support and love. And we would just say, even if you disagree with some of the ideology behind all of that, that's not a biblical move. That's like, There may be times something extreme like that has to happen, but so many of the stories that I hear about or people that I talk to, they weren't the extremes. They were just like, well, you know, we can't approve of you like this, and so you're cut off. And the harm, it's like we're robbing people from the safest places to be able to wrestle through some of this stuff.
Yeah, it's so backwards.
Yeah. So let's just start there. And we got a question about, you know, somebody has a friend who's transitioning, and do I encourage this or not encourage this? And what's a Christian posture? And I think that's an interesting question to explore. There are parts of the ideology I don't buy. You know, when having a daughter has introduced me to how unique the experience is of a girl being a girl. But I also don't feel the need to go out and demonize a whole group of people. Even though I have concerns, you know what I mean? And I'm just saying.
Yeah, well, I think in some ways it's kind of like the gift shop park thing again, where you're going from a two-dimensional view of something to a three or four-dimensional view of something.
Right.
So it's like
right.
a lot of these things are not what someone wrote down on a pamphlet for you.
Yeah.
There's going to be more to it. And at the end of the day, like you said, we're talking about human beings. We're not talking about.
That's right. We're not talking about issues or ideologies.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yep. So I want to make room around my table for people who have deep concerns about the way some of the gender stuff is framed. And I want to make room for people who are trans and or are thinking about it. And somehow, how do we love and serve each other? And obviously, there are people who don't like this posture from us or others. You know, they would argue, hey, we're aiding and abetting. And obviously, these are massive, massive issues. All I know is this. When I dip my toe into the scholarly literature around this, it is so vastly complicated that... and there are iterations upon iterations of different flavors of this. Like, I don't know. I think we just have to start with, you know, square one, which is trans people, LGBTQ people, whatever people are all made in the image of God and worthy, therefore, of dignity, respect, love, whatever. And I think that's like, that's in Genesis 1. I mean, there's no qualifier here. That's what last episode was about, the royal dignity. If the, people have tried to add qualifiers, there's no qualifier here. So anywho, I know, and obviously I don't think any of these categories were in the ancient people. Obviously there are commands in the Torah about men presenting themselves as women. But I think here, like at the very beginning, I don't think there's intersex or gender as a social construct or any of those sorts of issues here. So I don't want to say too much more because I've exhausted the limit of my my thinking. But I think it's an implication of the text that it doesn't matter, every single person is image of God and therefore worthy of dignity, love, whatever. Yeah.
Take the things to be true and work with those.
And start there. And we start there. Exactly right. Exactly
right. The thing with the individual too, like this, I keep thinking about conversations we've had with Gombas in the past about, and we've talked about it quite a bit too, about being individualistic versus being part of a community. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting to look at it in this lens of like us as individuals, not meant to be remain as an individual, but that we are as an individual, you're one strand of a rope, or you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Like we are meant to come together as individuals into a communal thing.
Into something new.
Yes.
See, you're tapping into something, Tim. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
But well, I think it gets confusing for people because there's always, we've had so many conversations about being individualistic is not what we're called to. Die to self, communal is the thing, but we do see so much about being individual and then, but that's not the end, or that's not, there's not a period there. It's pushing towards something or being called to something. We're invited to something.
Yeah. That's right. And the thing that's so, you know, shocking to the individualistic American mind is that communities are not collections of individuals. Communities are something new that develop when individuals surrender.
Come together.
But they surrender a piece of their individuality for some greater whole.
Okay.
So there's something new that's brought into existence in a community that isn't just, hey, we're all just individually showing up here, right? And we know that when you're at a mega church and you're one of five services of 2,000 people each, none of us would go, well, that's community, right?
Right.
Because that's just individuals. That's an affiliate group of people who all decided to be interested in the same thing. But there's nothing that's created except, hey, I really like the thing that we're all here celebrating.
Right.
But community is this, I mean, the word communities comes from the word common. So there's something shared and sacrificed in common. And that creates something new that wasn't there previously. And so your point about, you know, how the church should function, it's back to the many and the one. the beauty that God is imaged, not when everyone's the same. He's imaged best when there's difference and then something's held in common and equally sacrificed. You know what I mean?
That's huge.
The picture. So marriage is a small picture of that, but it's not the only picture of that. And that's where the church becomes the place for particularly the people who aren't married for whatever reason. You know, they could be a sexual minority, they could be a widow or widower, they could be whatever, but it's there in the commonality. And so if we just in the place where we're to hold things in common, that we only highlight the nuclear family and sort of prioritize that, then we're not being the new humanity in the way that I think, you know, Jesus sort of intended us to be.
Going into Easter for some of the implications we already talked about, but also just for what you just said, like the church, that big mega church coming together thing, I feel like that is marketed as community, and you're being asked to come and be a part of this thing, or you are almost guilted into being a part of this thing, but it's not that. And
it's Easter's best it's not that.
Yeah. And Easter is one of the prime Sundays, obviously, where we try to get as many people into that room as possible. It just feels so counterintuitive.
I know.
To really belonging to something and exactly how you just said that. So it's just fascinating in light of where we are. And
it's changed my view of marriage. It's changed my view of family. It's changed my view of church.
Which then has implications to like, never mind. I'll go too many.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why we as a church community do not insist that we all agree is because, like,
I agree with you.
And there are, thank you. There are like minimums for what it is to be a Christian, you know, like Jesus died, Jesus rose, great. But besides that, there are so many different flavors of theology or emphasis. And so one of the reasons why we give great permission for people to believe how they believe is, first of all, we see Paul doing this all over the place as he's encouraging his churches. But secondly, we think the image of God is best represented not in uniformity, but in unity. And unity presupposes difference, right? You have to have it in order to have it, but unity.
That's good.
Yeah. So, and that's the reason. I mean, then you start working it out into, well, why should women be included in all levels of leadership? Because they bear the royal vocation too, you know, and so on and so on and so on. So, you know, you can see where you can go off into all sorts of wonderful murky waters. But Genesis wasn't written to address those things. And so we have to be careful when it's we're yanking verses out of Genesis into modern debates that Genesis was knit together. Tim Mackey, it's such a weird visual picture, but it works. So Mackey, who, by the way, I just love and adore and have so much respect for his scholarship and just the person he is. He talks about the Old Testament being
Bible
like
Project.
Bible Project, yes. Tim Mackey, John Collins. He talks about the Old Testament being like a quilt that's made and sewed together over generations. Mm-hmm. So evidently, I didn't know this, but quilts, you would sew pieces onto them, hand them down to your kids, and then your kids would add sections onto them and hand them down to their kids, and they would add sections onto them. And so you had one quilt. How many quilts are there? There's one. But how many pieces to that quilt? Well, you know, my great-great-grandmother did that piece, and my great-aunt did that piece, and my mom did that piece, and I did that piece. And the quilt, his point, is that the quilt functions like the Torah. What you have is a bunch of individual stories that have been pieced together to form a whole. And they only make sense in the whole. You know, you can only appreciate them fully in the whole. And if you rip a section out of a quilt and try to put it into a different quilt, you have to acknowledge that that's what you're doing. You're pulling a piece out of one quilt that tells one story to try to tell a different story that maybe that piece wasn't aware of. So when we get into gender debates, or we get into, I don't know, I mean, evolution, part of how we have to start in the Bible is respecting the quilt, that this section of Genesis is that this section 1-11 introduces all of the themes that are going to be explored throughout the entire Hebrew scriptures. It introduces the land. It introduces the concept of patriarchs. It introduces Yahweh. It introduces the sin problem of imaging the serpent. It introduces conflict between descendants. I mean,
which is why these first two chapters are so important.
Is it? It is. And if you don't get them right, then you're reading wrongly the rest of the way.
Totally. Yep.
So, and I'm not saying that there aren't times you could pull the quilt, a piece of the quilt out and apply it to a different quilt. We just have to be so very careful when we do that and acknowledge that that's what we're doing. Mm-hmm. And so when Genesis 1:27 gets deployed into modern gender debates, there may be a case for saying, well, I mean, this is what it says. There are only two genders. But we have to be careful as we do that. Namely, in two ways. One, that we're doing it in a way that honors the Imago Dei of everybody else in the conversation. And that Genesis 1 was not written to answer these questions. Right. You know what I mean? And so we just have to be careful. Yeah. Well, we just have to be careful. I mean, obviously, I pull Genesis threads into all sorts of conversations like we did last week. Like, well, what about euthanasia? You know, should people make decisions to end others' lives? And I'm going to say, nope, not at all. And here's the reason. So I'm not opposed to pulling quilts out for other quilts. It's just that it's done so cavalierly without regard to the original quilt. And it's done in a way that really harms people. Often.
That's the part. That's the thing is like nothing infuriates me more than Christians bending over backwards to ostracize others and looking for just trying so hard to dig and pull and tear to do with that being the goal.
Right.
That I just like, it drives me beyond.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because then it's like it's the whole intent is from a regardless of what the truth is, the entire intent is off.
Right. Right.
Because you're just doing it to dehumanize, to degrade, to push out.
Yeah, man, that's so interesting because when you read the rest, I mean, particularly the Torah, the first five books, all you're seeing is failure and disobedience and weirdness and, you know, never, I mean, there's not, even our heroes throughout the text are awful, you know?
Yeah.
Abraham selling out his wife so he doesn't get, you know, he doesn't get in trouble. Jacob scheming. I mean, good Lord, even the pinnacle of like the kingly line of David, man, that just turns into such a cluster. And so it's just weird because that like path of failure, the thing that jumps out isn't the failure. The thing that jumps out is God's relentless patience to work within the failure to bring about his purposes for the world. And the fact that we don't often have a similar patience with each other in the church is the very ironic, you know, deeply harmful piece of that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like lamenting the blood in the ground and... It's like, it's not just the patience with the left turns. There's also, God has such a huge amount of lament, it seems, within that for how much humans have suffered in
absolutely
those left turns.
Yeah. Yep. 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 So yeah, bro, totally with you. One more. And I think this addresses a little bit of the problem. Mm. The ruling of the humans is to be done in community. So all the plurals are around rule, right? Let them rule. Let them rule. And so as we've mentioned, of course, there is no command for the humans to rule over each other. But even as humans ruling over creation, they're to do it in community, male and female, right? And so you automatically, and just so I mean, and we're seeing this in the evangelical world, but in the greater world, I mean, absolute power corrupts, of course, absolutely, right? Mm-hmm. No shocker there. And our churches have been structured so that rule isn't in community. Rule is on the province of one set of shoulders that, you know, sometimes are male and female, but sometimes and most often are just male. And so you just get, you get so many left turns and so much harm done because a community isn't ruling together.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Yeah. And instead it's focused power that initially was going to be used to bring about great ends. And then like the ring in Lord of the Rings, it just corrupts us, you know, upon itself. I know. So
I just sat in that last night for like an hour in that book that I showed you that I was reading, but there's a whole chapter on.
Yes. Yes.
Lord of the Rings and that.
The whole Lord of the Rings is a meditation on power. I mean, it's
so interesting. And then how Gandalf and then Gadriel, how they both.
They have temptation moments. Yep.
But they both have to step away from it. And they're like the most holy of the beings.
That's right.
So interesting.
I mean, even Frodo gives in.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that's very
really only Sam kind of does it. Yeah. It's
yeah.
So
Sam's the only one. So here, I mean, just think about, we've looked at, you know, two verses, 26 and 27. You know, next is 28, where it talks about ruling and subduing. And so, I mean, but think about how much of the entire biblical storyline is set up already. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because the end of the story, Revelation 21 and 22, is just this being retold. But yeah. Now the community of, you know, of God has grown from a garden to now an entire city. But it's the same dignity. You know, Revelation talks about, and they will reign with God forever and ever. It's that reinstallation of the vocation. I mean, it's just awesome. So the point is how you start will determine how you cash out what it is Jesus came to do.
Yeah.
Huge. So anywho, have we touched enough of the bases on this?
I want to go for a few more hours because now it's like there's so many New Testament implications and there's so many things that we have gone, just like you just said, you take these out where we went kind of awry and then sort of pull them back in with things that Jesus said that are obviously linked to these chapters. It's just, I don't know.
Yeah.
But again, for the 1,000th time brings congruity to the story and really shows that A to B thread.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And there's and shows why Jesus was so intentional with using scripture the way he did. And like, just,
and why he had to be human.
Oh yeah.
He had to be human. The rescue plan had to come from within the human race.
That's so good.
So yes, it's awesome. Yeah. So, I love you. I love how much you enjoy thread pulling. You're the best.
I just love the congruity. It's nothing is more affirming for me than seeing the threads come together and not seeing.
Oh,
I think because growing up, it was the Bible was in isolated chunks and we were told it was one story, but it did not make sense together.
We never saw the quilt presented. We never saw the quilt.
Well, it's like they tore it apart and then we were just, it was just these pieces in random places that you would be told this is truth, but it doesn't jive with that one, but just take my word for it.
Yeah, exactly.
And now you're just seeing there is an intentional thing to all of this, and it's very encouraging.
Yeah, it really is. So anywho, friends, I mean, we're just going to keep marching. We're going to try to get Gambas back on the show. We have literally no publicity interview scheduled for anything. We are just free and clear to marinade, to deep dive, to, I don't know what other metaphors we can use here, but just savor the genesis. Thank you, dear community, literally and seriously, for all of your support, encouragement, kindness. You stimulate our thoughts and, you know, correct us at times. And it's just really an honor to do this. It really deeply is an honor to do this. So we love you all. Tim loves you all. Yep. He's making a face.
Can't see. Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah.
You get used to being a visual format that most people don't look at.
Yeah. I mean, maybe 12, 13. So, anywho, love you guys. See ya.
Peace. Thank you, thank you, thank you for listening to this conversation. The Voxology Podcast is a 501c3 nonprofit organization that is made possible by listeners just like you. If you'd like to partner with us, you can do so at patreon.com/voxologypodcast or on Tithe.ly, tithe.ly, search Voxology Podcast. You can interact with the hosts on Facebook/Voxology Podcast or on Instagram @Voxology Podcast and on Twitter or X, whatever it is, @MikeErie. Thank you, thank you, thank you for walking this long road with us.